Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's April 9th, 2022, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can find me hanging out at overthecap.com, where you can reach me at Jason@overthecap.com. Nelly the Bunny is a little bit active in the background. Nelly just got a treat and is, I don't know, hopping around doing something. Nelly, you have anything else to add besides how excited you are for your treat? No? Just a little hop? Okay. So we'll see what Nelly's got going on later on. Our beer of the night tonight is the Brooklyn Stonewall Inn IPA. This is one of the low-calorie IPAs. I think I kind of made a bad decision getting this one for tonight. I mean, I may swap this out after just one tonight and see whatever else I have floating around in the fridge. My wife wanted to go to Cheesecake Factory tonight, so we did the Cheesecake Factory where they had the Cricket Hill on tap. So I said, I'll try that one because most of the places that I go to don't have Cricket Hill. They'll have some other kind of localish stuff and a couple other things maybe on tap, but usually not that. I said I would try that. But going from that to a light IPA is just not a, it's not a good choice. You gotta, I think you gotta start with the light one if you're actually gonna have that. So if we have a second or third of these, we'll save this maybe till next week, and maybe I can give it a little bit more of a fairer review, because right now it's just, after having something different, just doesn't really work jumping into this one. So not the best of choices for beer of the night, but I'm sure I have as a reserve. I'm sure we got some 60 minute or something upstairs, so once I get through this one, I think we'll switch up to something a little bit different for the second half, or I don't know, the next two thirds, I guess, of this one. We'll see how long this actually goes for. So on a personal note, my son turned 7, which really makes me feel old. my daughter is 12. She'll be 13 this year. And I was thinking about it today. Like, it's kind of hard to believe. I remember when years ago I was doing the podcast with Bryce a little bit. And my daughter, who was pretty little at the time, Jacob was like a newborn. Megan would come and pop on the podcast. And now she's about to be a teenager. Jacob's turning 7. It's like, wow, I don't know. So I did try to splurge and get him one of these VR headsets he's been asking for. I don't know. That thing is very different than the kind of gaming stuff that I grew up on. So I got to figure out what are the things to keep him entertained on that he can work with. Right now he's playing the demo versions of Beat Saber, which seemed like it was kind of fun. Some of the other stuff that we try to download, I'm trying to find demo games on it. I'm trying to find stuff that he can play, since I can't really sit there with him and try to show him how to do it. So that'll be an adventure. But I tell you, I've never seen somebody so excited about having a birthday for like the last 3 weeks. It's been absolutely torturous for how much he's wanted to have this birthday party. But happy birthday to him. So I told him that I would mention his birthday on the podcast. He was excited, I guess, about that. I'll see if he pops his way down here, probably to ask me something about his VR headset. But maybe he'll pop on for a second. I'll try to get him to say hi the way Megan used to say hi every now and then. So on to some NFL stuff. Wasn't the busiest week in the NFL, that was for certain. We've now hit the kind of dead period before we really ramp up the discussions for the draft. You know, those are kind of ongoing right now, but it'll ramp up as we get a little bit closer to it. But we did have a big trade this week, and I think that was really the main thing that I wanted to talk about, because I looked at this as such an awful trade for New Orleans. The New Orleans Twitterverse has gotten very, very sensitive to anything negative about the Saints. There's a couple teams that get that way, a couple teams fan bases that get that way when you talk negative about stuff. The Saints is clearly one of them. That this sets off a fuse anytime you say anything negative about the way they operate at times. But I think one of the things that I don't understand, and this comes a lot with draft trades and when you talk about them, obviously it happened last year with the Jets when I was talking about the guard they traded for and everything else. You grade a trade when the trade occurs. You use whatever data exists to try to figure out how that trade likely works out for the two sides. The feedback that you get on it from people is, let them pick the players. Let's see how the players are. Let's see this, let's see that. That's true to some extent. You know, obviously they're putting in a lot of work into grading players and coming up with the draft orders for how they have the players ranked. But when you have years and years and years and years of draft data, and it's not just player by player, position by position, it's also team by team, there's not a lot of differences that exist to where you look at certain teams and go, wow, they're exceptional at the draft. There might be a couple teams that are pretty bad at the draft. There might be a couple. And that, even that's probably fluky. But there's not really teams where you would say, wow, they're so good at the draft that every move they make is going to be solid gold. You know, for every, you know, I'll use a Jets one again, for every Darrell Revis you pick, who's a, you know, Hall of Famer, great cornerback, you know, one of the greatest cornerbacks of all time, even if it was a kind of a short highlight career that he had. For every one of those players you pick, that same front office picks Vernon Golston, who is one of the worst draft selections of the last, you know, 20 years. So the extremes exist everywhere. You know, just because the New Orleans Saints a couple of years ago had a fantastic draft doesn't mean that they're going to have a fantastic draft this year. It doesn't mean that getting an extra first round pick magically means they're getting, you know, the second best player somehow in the draft. You know, they're not picking number two, you know, they're picking number 16, right? Number 16 and 19, I think. No, I'll pull up the numbers in a second. But, you know, not only that, in most cases, you're trading up for a specific player. This is a completely blind trade. You know, the closest thing I would have said to a blind trade was the Jets when they moved up in the year that they got Darnold. And that wasn't as blind. I mean, they had a high pick, but it was, they basically narrowed their choices down to three players. I would imagine that the board probably, I would guess the Jets board was Mayfield, Darnold, Allen, and they knew they were going to get one of those three guys with where they selected that year. But it was still blind. I mean, it was basically saying, well, you know, we believe that, you know, any of these three players is worthwhile. And, you know, for a quarterback, that kind of makes some sense, I guess you would say. This, What are you doing? So you're adding number 16. You can't have a specific target in mind. People say, well, watch what they do. They might be trading up to get someone to get a quarterback. You know, meaning they'll make another trade after this. I mean, this does give you that ammunition, but you're not doing it for that purpose. If you did it for that purpose, it would be like the Miami-San Francisco trade, Miami-San Francisco-Philadelphia trade, which was essentially a three-team trade that they executed as two individual trades that took place over the course of a day or two. My take on the trade is simply this, from New Orleans' perspective. If you look at New Orleans' salary cap situation today, you look at their situation tomorrow, you look at their situation 2 years from now, they're probably not in a position where they're going to be adding a lot of players in free agency. It's just not going to happen. They had to move every single contract they had down to the minimum this year. Basically, every single contract on the team to get down to the minimum so they could try to create the room to bring in Deshaun Watson. That didn't happen. Now, my assumption is they're going to sit on that salary cap space because they need it next year, so they need to carry it over. I don't think they'll keep adding players this year through free agency. But they have a veteran roster, especially on defense. You have a lot of veterans on that team, and they're not players you're going to be getting rid of next year. You know, they're in this what you see is what you get phase, not a lot different than Philadelphia. Now, I praise Philadelphia for the way they handle stuff, but they're basically in like a 3-year roster freeze, where you're adding little bits and pieces, but you can't really do much else than that. So my thought is, when you look at the kind of the age of their roster, what they think might be a win now roster, they're looking to add as many parts as they can right now. And the only, not the only way, but the best way they feel they can do that is by bringing in an extra first round pick this year. But it is a weird decision. You have a draft that A, is not quarterback heavy, and you're a team that needs a quarterback. B, it's just considered a down draft overall. I talked about how this year was just so odd. Like, free agency in my mind was a dud. You know, free agency was exciting, not because of the free agents. Free agency was exciting because of the trades, specifically trades for quarterbacks. That was the excitement of free agency. The excitement of free agency really wasn't player movement. Was anyone really excited about Allen Robinson signing with the Rams? No. The excitement was all about trades. But this was an oddball year. Not only did free agency kind of look bad, but the draft looked kind of bad. You know, you would have the buzzwords, well, it's not a draft of traditional game changers. It's not a draft of, you know, traditional top 10 style picks, but it's a draft that has a lot of good depth at position A, B, and C. That's usually kind of buzzword for, this isn't a very good draft, but we cover the draft. We've got to talk about the draft. So let's put our best foot forward in trying to explain what this draft is going to be this year. And typically most drafts end up kind of falling along the same lines, with the exception of the quarterback stuff. Quarterbacks kind of fluctuate a lot year by year. The other stuff kind of seems to fall into a pattern, but every now and then you do get years that are kind of terrible. And this, on paper, from what people say, would seem to be one of those years, just like free agency. So I don't understand why you're that interested in adding an extra first this year. Like, that seems odd to me. But the second thing, and this is really what makes no sense at all to me. If you do not have a viable quarterback on your roster, somebody tweeted me that they have three. Your quarterbacks are Jameis Winston, Andy Dalton, and Taysom Hill. You're telling me that is three viable quarterbacks? Look, Winston is fun. All right. He's a higher talent version of maybe a Ryan Fitzpatrick. Maybe he's a similar talent version of a Vinny Testaverde, where they can do some things with their arm that are pretty exciting, and then they do some boneheaded stuff that leads to a pick six or something that's going to be a touchdown for the other team. I don't want to hear about Jameis's record last year. They put him in a bottle to try to minimize the mistakes, and they would let him take a couple of big chances here and there. But you have zero viable quarterbacks on your roster. Andy Dalton is a $3 million a year quarterback. He did nothing with the Dallas Cowboys. He did nothing with the Chicago Bears. He will do nothing on the New Orleans Saints if they ask him to play. Taysom Hill, they're going to move back to tight end. Taysom Hill is so bad as a quarterback, they needed to bring in Andy Dalton as a backup. Jameis Winston, where was Jameis Winston during all this Deshaun Watson talk? If Jameis Winston was a viable quarterback, don't you think Carolina would have signed him? Don't you think Atlanta would have signed him? Don't you think any of these teams would have signed him? Don't you think last year Jameis Winston would have signed for more than, what did he sign for, 5.5? Let me see what he signed for. Just to give you an idea of how viable he is in a league where everybody makes money. Jameis Winston last year was $5.5 million base value. 12.5 upside. This year they paid 14. Why? They didn't have a choice. They didn't have another quarterback. Even if Atlanta wasn't interested, I'm sure he could have said, well, yeah, I'm getting calls from Atlanta. 2 years ago, Jameis Winston came into free agency. He signed with New Orleans as a backup for 1.1. Upside of 4.5. You're telling me that's a high-level quarterback? Might he put together a good season? He might. But he's not a viable long-term solution. If he was a viable long-term solution, you wouldn't have 3 years signing for this to be on the Saints. You don't even know if you have a viable head coach. Losing Sean Payton was one of the biggest losses of the entire offseason for any team in the NFL. Is it as big as Russell Wilson leaving the Seahawks? Maybe not, but it's probably not that far off. There are a couple of coaches in this league that get so much out of teams, and he's one of those types of coaches. You know, he's one of those rare guys that you see when you look back and you go, you know, it was a miracle that that team was around 500. Sean Payton should have won Coach of the Year last season. I don't care if they didn't make the playoffs. The job he did with the quarterbacks they had on that roster, including Winston, was phenomenal. And he stepped away because there was nothing more that he could do with that team. There's nothing more. And you saw the writing on the wall that there was nothing more they could really do to improve that roster. Now, I don't think he would have thought in a million years they could have made a play at Deshaun Watson. But there wasn't much that they could do. You lose players. You know, they're one of the biggest losers of the offseason. People say, well, you know, Armstead was always hurt. That's true. 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, you were probably all saying, well, no, they're going to keep Armstead. They have a plan in place. Oh, no, they have a plan. No, they couldn't keep him. And he didn't sign the Trent Williams contract. He didn't sign for 23 a year. He signed for 15. Didn't make fiscal sense for them to do it because of where they are right now. They couldn't do that. The Saints, when you look at everything there, the Saints have a far better chance of probably finishing in the bottom 10 than they do as a playoff team. When you have no quarterback on your roster, under no circumstances can you give up a first round pick in the future. Because if you do something like that, you run the risk of watching another team take your pick and select their quarterback of the future. And sometimes, even when you do have a viable quarterback, you don't want to do that. Look at Seattle. They're sitting there right now with Drew Lock as their quarterback, and they lost their first-round pick because they traded away to the Jets for a safety. You look at the Indianapolis Colts, who took a giant risk on Carson Wentz, and they gave up a first-round pick because they thought, well, maybe he'd be our future. Now they have the shell of Matt Ryan back there, hoping that he can recapture something by playing in Indianapolis. So, from a logical standpoint, this to me makes no sense for New Orleans at all. From Philadelphia's standpoint, I think it's genius. I think this is absolutely a great move by them, because what Philadelphia is doing is Philadelphia is seeing this. All right. They're seeing every team in the NFL, not every team, but a lot of teams still use this, what I consider a very outdated model, where you look at draft picks in the future and you go, well, we have to discount them. Why? Is next year's first rounder not a first rounder? Because you haven't been able to scout? I can go on 15 websites, and I can probably get a early thought, early recommendations or early analysis of the 2023 NFL draft. we already know from what people have said that this draft looks like it's a lower tier draft. So is it going to be worse? Probably can't be. Because the drafts where you get this, like, well, it's not a very good draft, usually only happen once every couple of years. Odds of it being back-to-back, probably kind of limited. Are the players next year that you select in that slot somehow magically not going to be a first-rounder? Like, if I pick, let's say the Saints even win the Super Bowl, and I'm picking number 32, is that 32 somehow really going to give me the value of player number 64? No, it just means I have to wait a year to make the pick. So if you want to say that there's some type of premium someone has to pay because the other team has to wait, I can buy that a little bit. But I'm not going to call this a discount. That's just stupid. You know, if you want to take into uncertainty, all that kind of stuff, sure. You know, you can factor that all in, but to discount these things by a full round or two rounds because you're going to wait till next year? I mean, come on. Philadelphia had 3 first-round picks this year. Sometimes taking 3 first-round picks at the same time isn't the best of things, especially if you have a draft that you think is maybe a little bit on the weaker side. Having 3 first-round picks sometimes brings some issues with it. All right, sometimes, especially if this draft is heavy on certain positions, you don't want to load up on one position in one draft. That's an issue. From a contractual perspective, it really ups your budget on the year if you have to pay 3 first-round draft picks in the same year. And not only does it up it this year, but it ups your budget and your salary cap situation. This year doesn't impact your salary cap situation as much, but 5 years from now, if those players are all are on options, and it's probably a rarity that all 3 would end up on it, but if you get to that point, you would have 3 players on an option year. You know, that could be, depending on how good they are, that could be as much as like 3 transition tags. It's not going to be 3 franchise tags, but let's say 3 transition tags. You could have that. Then on top of that, it might compromise you when you're doing extensions because you'd have 3 players, which means you'd have 3 franchise tag potential players after the 5th year. You can only use it on 1, so that might pigeonhole you. So sometimes it's better to split those up. The other thing from Philadelphia's standpoint, Philadelphia does not have a viable quarterback. All right, Jalen Hurts has shown some potential. I don't think there's anyone that would say that Jalen Hurts is without a doubt the guy. Philadelphia should be a little bit gun-shy for making Carson Wentz the guy before he really showed that. If Carson Wentz had been drafted number 28, or if Carson Wentz was drafted number 35, Carson Wentz wouldn't have gotten the contract he got. They wouldn't have done that as quickly. I think you had the confirmation bias of where they drafted him and what he did that one season that led to that big extension early on. So when you have that, and now you have a draft this year where you look at the quarterbacks and go, all right, Hurts is as good of an option as the quarterbacks who are in this draft. And we might still pick one, but he's probably as good of an option as the players that are in this draft. So what do we do? Well, why don't we get an extra one next year? Because maybe next year we will decide that we definitely need to get a quarterback. And that gives you 2 opportunities. Really, it gives you 3 opportunities to get to a quarterback at that point. Because what they've done now is they have their first pick, their own pick. So let's say that the Eagles stink. Let's say Hurts stinks or gets hurt or something like that, and they're terrible. They have their own opportunity to get a top pick. Let's say the Saints stink. Well, now they have the Saints' opportunity to get a top pick. Let's say both are mediocre, just like they were last year. Well, you've now got 2 first-round picks that you can use to package if one of these teams that doesn't want to take a quarterback wants to trade down and you need to move up. This gives you the firepower to move up. So you've got the you stink option of getting a quarterback, the they stink option of getting a quarterback, or the trade up. So you create a scenario to where you can move up to get that QB. You know, and if you want to move up, there's a couple of other positions that maybe you can justify a trade up for. Probably not, but the quarterback is really the one. But, you know, it, this gives you those avenues to do that. And again, when you get into the whole nonsense of the discount thing, what is Philadelphia really losing here? If you take that away, Philadelphia sends over number 16, right? And they're going to drop down to 18. So you're going to lose two spots, or you could look at it as moving up one to get 16, whatever it is. They're basically giving up the 16th pick. Let's call the high pick the one they're giving up. So they're giving up 16. Well, what are the odds? The odds are that next year you would get the average selection would be number 16. When you look at New Orleans, like I mentioned before, when you look at their quarterbacks on the roster, when you look at the change at the coaching position, when you look at the age on that roster and some of the spots on the team, you should be far more bullish that that selection is going to be better than number 16. That you should be giving up 16 and you have a better chance of getting number 10 than you do something like 26 or, you know, 22, 23. And if you fall a couple spots, okay, you fell a couple of spots. If it's a stronger draft, that's actually probably a better pick. So it's not a big deal to drop down when you're talking about such a average kind of draft pick that you're giving up. And then on top of that, for your troubles, you get a second round pick in 2024 just because. So, I mean, when you look at this package, I mean, it's pretty crazy. They give up 16 to move down, I'm sorry, to move up one spot. So they give up 16, they give up 19, they get 18. So they want to call it moving down two, I don't know. However you want to look at it, they're getting back round three this year. They're doing a 6-7 swap. That's a whatever. You're getting first round pick in 2023 and a second round pick in 2024. I mean, that is a huge win for them. So if you look at this, so I used a chart that Brad and I came up with. And the chart Brad and I came up with is based on, and admittedly, it's not the biggest sample size. Now, we worked on ways to make it bigger by, you know, you don't look at the specific draft slot itself. No, you're looking at a range of potential outcomes that can be there. And we'll update this at some point in the future for, you know, now that we have more data from since when we wrote it, because I think the fundamental analysis of how we did this is spot on. I think there's some minor tweaks maybe we could do. One is just having a couple more drafts of input that we can put in there. The other thing might be instead of using the top five, maybe we use top 10. I've used top 10 for a couple other things. And in some cases that's actually worked out, I think, a little bit better, but you know, that's nitpicking, I think. If you don't discount the picks at all, basically the Eagles, this would be the equivalent of them getting the 15th overall pick in the draft. You know, they'd be bringing in about 5,000 points, and the Saints only bringing in 3,400 points. All right, let's discount it for the uncertainty. I'll discount it completely for the uncertainty. We'll put those picks at the end of the first round. 4,500 to 3,400. That's like getting a second round pick, the 40th overall pick in the draft. That's pretty good. All right, let's go with the traditional discount. So that would be a mid-second round pick, a mid-fourth round pick. You know, because the second round pick we're claiming is 2 years later. So we'll drop it to a four, and we're dropping the one to a two. Still a gain of 617 points, 110th overall. You get a little bit closer if you want to discount it all the way as an end of the second, end of the fourth. That's like getting the 167th overall pick. It's a premium of 400 points paid by New Orleans, which is still a lot. You know, but this is Philadelphia gaming the system. This is them using the Jimmy Johnson charts and the discount factors and all that stuff that just in the grand scheme of things, if you're running an organization and you have a long-term vision, even if it's not a long-term, if you have a three-year vision, and I understand not every general manager is going to get there. New Orleans is going to be 3 years. This guy's been there forever. But if you have a three-year vision, there is no way that you could turn this trade down. Now, if you're on the hot seat and you're just doing what you can to save a job, I get it. But my goodness, a blind trade up, you know, you might come away with a center and a linebacker. That's insanity. Could you imagine giving up what could be the eighth pick in the draft next year for what turned out to be like a linebacker or a safety? Could you just imagine? It's bad planning, I think. So I think it's a great trade by Philadelphia. I think it's completely exploiting all the inefficiencies. You know, one of the words that I don't know if they would throw this one around, they might. Optionality, that's what they're doing. They're increasing their options. They're increasing their opportunities in the future by giving up one pick this year in a draft they're probably not crazy about. Absolutely brilliant move for them. So I love this from their perspective. I don't really get it from New Orleans' perspective. It just seems so short-sighted. I don't even know how many first-round picks really step in and give you that kind of over-the-topness this year. Next year they would. First year, sometimes that's difficult. Depends a little bit on the position. And I know they've had a couple of guys who have had success before. But, you know, that's rare to get that kind of contribution from a rookie to, you know, really push over the top. So I just think this is, you know, one of those examples where Philadelphia continues to show themselves as just way ahead of the curve of all these other teams in the NFL when it comes to finding ways to exploit these weaknesses among other teams. These inefficiencies that exist within the league and the way that we value draft picks, value players, value contracts, value all this stuff. They just do a better job than everybody else at finding those avenues and trying to exploit them. So we had a couple big contracts that came down this week. Got the dogfish head now, so we're in a little bit of a better position after getting through that one, struggling through the stone wall. We'll try that one again next week. We'll see if we get a little better reaction to that. So anyway, a couple of the bigger deals we got some details on. Just talk about those real quick. So Xavien Howard comes in, and it was reported as a $25 million a year contract. Obviously, I've talked about this revaluating the way that we're revaluing these contracts. So I opted in the opposite direction for this one than I've done on some in the past. I did not value this as a $25 million contract over 2 years. When you got down to the numbers on this, and it was very clear that this was negotiated as a pure new 5-year contract. You can kind of tell sometimes when you have these annual values that come out all wonky. You kind of say, wow, that's kind of a weird one. This to me was very clearly done as a brand new 5-year contract, where they were basically saying, okay, this is going to supersede the contract that you signed in 2019 and the minor restructure that you did in 2021, and this is going to be a brand new deal. So essentially, this works out for him, you know, to where he's going to make about, let's see, what was he going to earn on the old contract? Let's see. He was going to earn about $39.3 million. Now he'll earn, I think it's 55, assuming that he gets there. That's not all guaranteed. So, you know, that's about a 15 raise. You could look at it maybe the first 2 years. Really, it's these 2 years that are guaranteed on there. So if you pull out that, you know, it's about a $10 million raise, which is pretty good based on where he was. The Dolphins could have held firm on that and, you know, try to do some stuff in that regard. He does not get a favorable vesting date in the third year of this contract. So he has to be on the roster. I think it's on the second day of the league year. I can't remember if it's the second or third. I think it's the second day of the league year, and he gets $4 million. Really, he gets $4 million guaranteed. Really, it's $7 million guaranteed because he has a roster bonus on that same day. Now, second day of the league year is kind of an oddball day. Why would Miami say second day versus first day? The reason for that is his contract is going to have a ton of dead money in it if his play trails off. And I don't even know if Howard was, you know, as good as he had been in the past last year. I don't think he really was. But anyway, if they needed to move on from him by doing a second day versus a first day, this gives them the chance to use a June 1 on him still. So they can use a June 1 to avoid the guarantee, to avoid the roster bonus being paid, and they can hold his cap number to be very high. You know, they can hold it at a 26. But his dead money that year would be, let me see, I just have our back end up, 13, 19, you know, 24, 25. So this gives him some options to do that, to basically have a push on the number in 2024 and then open it up for when they have to sign rookies and stuff like that by cutting most of that money off. So I think that's the reason for the second day of the league year, things that are on there. Why not the third day? They just decided to do second. You know, that gives them a little bit more of an assurance for his side and whatnot. You know, I think from a precedence level, it does open, it opens kind of a bad kind of precedent, I think, for certain stuff in the future, to where you have a player who 2 years into his contract was very unhappy for whatever reasons and basically gets them to add a bunch of incentives into the deal, or some incentives, not a bunch of incentives, but gets them to add some incentives to move some money up, I guess, a little bit to do some things. You know, they did some stuff there that is kind of out of the ordinary, and now you're kind of saying we'll tear up the deal and do a new one. Now, they didn't work on a new money basis, so that's something that can help you a little bit. So you work within the constructs of the current market as a way to kind of structure the contract and structure the deal that maybe makes sense to you. But I do think it sets kind of a bad precedent for them. I think they were, you know, this is a season where clearly they're trying to make a lot of moves to, you know, make a splash and kind of go all in. So you're trying to keep everybody happy and, you know, all that kind of stuff that I think goes into it. But I think this was getting pressured by Howard's agent, who I think exerted a lot of force in the last 2 years on Miami. You know, obviously comes out and puts out the public statements afterwards, thanking them, you know, the people involved, Brandon Shore, you know, a lot of the people involved in the process and getting this kind of historic deal done, yada, yada, yada. But I think he put a lot of pressure on them and they kind of fell for it in the last 2 years, and they probably shouldn't have. The deal he signed a couple of years ago was not a good contract, but it wasn't an awful contract. It was a contract that what happened was, now he's been a player that's been up and down because of injuries and stuff, but I think really what occurred there is you had a situation where the market was what it was, and I think there probably was a lack of vision as to what the market might become in the future. I'm not the best at that either. You know, you sometimes have to be very aggressive with the way that you view players. And sometimes that's hard to do because you're used to seeing the way the NFL typically operates, which is a lot of stability in the salaries. But every now and then you do have to know that there are positions that are kind of up for a market correction of sorts. And corner was one of those positions. And I think they probably just missed the boat a little bit that market was going to be at a place to where he probably should have gotten to like 16-17 versus I think the 15-25. And I think that's what opened this, I'm sorry, 15-05. So he became the highest paid, but it was only for a brief second because the free agents, you know, afterwards did better, including Byron Jones on the same team, which I think is what set him off. I think that's the one that set him off. Jones was, what, 16-5? Let me see. Byron Jones is, yeah, 16-5. So when you see Byron Jones coming in at 16-5 just a couple months after you signed this deal, well, that tells you you should have pushed Miami much harder. And I think that's really what brought it about. So, you know, maybe to some extent Miami thought that he took a deal that he probably shouldn't have taken, so they were a little bit more willing to reopen it. But I think by and large, they just got really, I don't know, taken here a little bit. But the numbers, you know, when you hear about $40 million guaranteed and, you know, 55 total, he's got the 40 full, but you know, when you look what he was supposed to earn before, obviously that's a increase for him. You know, certainly it's a increase in the amount. I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong numbers that are here. I'm reading the Jones contract. Like, wait a minute, that's not his number should be 36.3. But when you read the 36.3 full and 40.3 total, you know, the 36.3 full, you know, it's that $10 million extra, which is good. But, you know, it's not like this overwhelming guarantee when you consider where he was at, you know, on the contract before. So, you know, there's a couple different ways, I think, that you can kind of look at it, you know, to see where the eye-poppingness part of the numbers kind of isn't there as much. But it's a solid deal. It's got a void year in there. You know, the other thing that I think was misreported on this one, I think he only has one incentive. I think it's like a one-timer. Like, you can earn it once. It was reported, I think it's like $5 million in incentives. I think it's just $1 million in incentives. I think it's a, you know, once you earn it once, then that's yours. That's it. You don't get to earn it a second time. So that was the deal there. The other one was Bobby Wagner. And that was one that was always going to come under criticism simply because he represented himself. It's an okay contract. I mean, there's nothing with this deal that is bad. There's nothing that's great. Bobby Wagner's a really good football player. Bobby Wagner's also an older football player who's just cut. Even when you're a great player who's cut, sometimes it's hard to get a big contract coming off being released. Teams don't look at you the same way. You know, look at J.J. Watt. J.J. Watt got released last year, right? J.J. Watt signed for 14 a year. Chandler Jones got 17 a year. You know, they both have some of the same issues. And Watt got a terrific contract coming off being cut, you know, because he got Arizona to jump in the mix. But, you know, it's not easy to get those big deals when you're cut. Wagner, from what was reported, I think he's probably got more upside in this contract than a lot of people are kind of giving some credit for. You know, when you look at the cash outlay and what was the potential in some other spots, you know, he has a chance to, he's probably got a good chance to get his guarantee on the books for 2024. So he might have that kind of locked down. You know, when it comes to this, I'm just looking at the numbers here as to how his deal works out. The contract basically follows the typical Rams structure that they use for a lot of their deals. So it's not like they, got a different kind of structure in here. Same basic stuff where you have that guaranteed roster bonus in the second year with the, pretty sure that's got a no offset on it. They have a lot of incentive clauses in there. Like this was one of those. So, you know, I think Florio was the one that kind of led the charge to kind of speak negative on the deal before coming back around. And I'm going to assume somebody reached out to him to talk to him about the deal. And then he kind of came around and said, well, yeah, it wasn't as bad as I first thought. And maybe he didn't say exactly that, but it seemed like there was a second round of discussing the deal that, you know, it wasn't that bad. You know, it was like there was a deal made where there's crazy names to the incentives in the contract, as if it was like something they did to entice him to come to the team. They do that with all their deals. Look, the Rams, I'll say about some of the stuff that, you know, maybe they don't need to be doing palindromes in their base salaries or something, and you know, some of their stuff goes over the top, but they're a front office. You give them this. They like to have fun with the stuff that they do. And that's the way that I look at a lot of the things they do with their contracts. All their players have these things that have funny names to them. They let the guys have fun with the contracts to be like, okay, this is an incentive package. Let's put a name on it. And they do that. And it's not something that was like, weird to this deal. Is it something weird to the NFL? Yeah, it's weird to the NFL. Is it weird to the Rams? No. All their players that have incentives have these clauses in them that have funky, silly names. So, you know, I don't really get that that part at all. I think when you just look at the stuff, I think the only thing here that was kind of a weird inclusion is the ability to void the contract. That's kind of meaningless. I don't really even get why that was there. But, you know, it's just a standard NFL contract. You know, as a couple of players do their deals, it's really hard to see. You know, we try to be impartial when we talk about the contracts, or at least I try to be. You know, I know a lot of the people do. Bobby Wagner made a statement about, you know, the contract, about how everybody becomes a contract expert when a player negotiates his own deal. And he's probably right about that to some extent. You know, it's a it's a thing. A lot of the news that gets to all your big reporters is going to come from agents. And when that happens, sometimes you do things to I don't know, kind of, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back, kind of bit. And it was so evident when Russell Kuhn did his deal back in, oh, I don't know, it was a long time ago. It was the one he did with Denver. And I mentioned this on Twitter. It was a coordinated hit job. It was like the mob was out and they said, go get him. I had never seen anything like it. Like, if this is your job, and I understand that, you know, somebody signs a deal and you've got six guys who receive the same text and basically copy and paste the text verbatim, some bizarre contract statistic or some bizarre salary milestone that they will give you that obviously nobody's researched on their own. Especially not six people at once knowing the same bizarre statistic. I get that. But to have the contract come out and to have the numbers that came out. Let me pull up his deal here. So Broncos, here we go. This was in 2016. So the numbers came back, and the deal at the time was, I think it was nothing guaranteed. And it was like 10-6 a year, $6 million in the first year, nothing guaranteed. And I remember the tweet. I can still envision them on there basically saying, there it is, he got killed. He got killed without an agent. And it was just, it was awful. Like, I don't know how you could put that out there without seeing any details on the deal. Just hearing nothing guaranteed, six first year going, he got killed. Now, I don't think people knew that he was working, you know, with a former agent at the time. A guy who's really good. You know, he was working with him. So it's not like he didn't have someone advising him who was familiar with the contract stuff. So as you got into the deal itself, he had let me just see here. Oh, maybe he did have $1 million guaranteed. He might have had a $1 million salary advance or something. Yeah, this is a while ago. Yeah, so it was, he had a $1 million workout bonus. So, I mean, that's basically guaranteed. You have to not want to show up to work out to not earn $1 million. Yeah, that's pretty difficult. He gets $2 million for being healthy for a game. So unless they were going to cut him, he gets $2 million. And, you know, then you get the $2 million when you sign. When you looked at the deal, it was a deal that basically said, okay, I didn't get big interest in free agency. I'm going to sign for a contract that has reachable incentives, has some money that I'll probably earn in the first year, and then I'm going to give him an option to opt into a contract that would have paid him around $11.5 million a year, which at the time was high in the left tackle market. So nobody looked at it that way. It was just, he got killed. You know, doing that deal without an agent, he couldn't do anything right. And it didn't matter if there were other players who signed deals that were similar. Like, you didn't hear about, give you an example here, because I know I mentioned this one back then. Now he was older. But, you know, the following year, let me see. Or I'm sorry, the year before, Andrew Whitworth had signed an extension that had $2 million in guaranteed money. That was it. Now, part of that's because he's on the Bengals. But still, he only got a $2 million raise. It was $9 million extra pay over 1 year. Russ set himself up for a contract where he could earn about $8 million in that first year, which he did. Then he got cut and he signed a better deal with Los Angeles. But yeah, everybody kind of came out and was just extremely negative on it before even the details came out. You know, before they even came out. And, you know, I didn't get that at all. Now, I disagree with him that people don't talk about contracts otherwise. There are people who talk about contracts all the time. Do some people have more of a slant on the way they talk about them? Yeah, they probably do. But, you know, he is right that the players representing themselves do get kind of bashed. You know, Sherman got it, but Sherman's deserved it. Sherman's was a terrible contract. There's no way that you could look at that Sherman deal and say, hey, this was a good deal. But the problem is when the player does it themselves, somehow it's magically simply because they didn't have an agent in the first place. They may have had somebody advising them. We pretend that didn't happen. But the thing is, there are plenty of agents who at times, and they might be really good agents, do deals that are kind of crappy. You know, you go back and you look at those deals and go, that wasn't a home run. You know, we probably cost ourselves some money with that contract. Everson Griffin had an agent. I'm sorry, not Everson Griffin. Danielle Hunter. I don't know why I said Griffin. Hunter had an agent. How was his contract? That wasn't a great contract. He's been fighting to get out of that one for years. And that wasn't a good deal. We said it wasn't a good deal the minute he signed it. We said it was a joke. We said the Mahomes contract wasn't any good when he signed it. Like, this was just going to get surpassed very quickly. They all have agents. They have agents who have done good jobs for other players. In those cases, they didn't do a good job. But they don't get ripped to shreds for it. And I think that's one of the differences. And I think that's kind of unfair. I've been on the record with the Lamar Jackson stuff, that I do think that without an agent, or it doesn't seem as if he has like an advisor who I guess is really familiar with the stuff. I think there are certain things that the Ravens do with their contracts that are probably difficult to frame if you're not really familiar with the way that the contracts work. And that might be a little bit difficult, for them to come to an agreement with, because he's probably very focused on the biggest picture stuff, which is going to be something like 45, 46, 47 million a year, all guaranteed, something like that. But, to say that he doesn't have a deal because he doesn't have an agent yet, I mean, come on, that's ridiculous. So I think we just need to take a step back when we talk about this stuff, but you got to be honest with it and be honest with the people that you have relationships with, that, you can't just blow smoke over every single possible thing that's done. When you have a player who's released, you can't go out there and be like, oh my goodness, that's a great free agent who's out there. Somebody's going to pick up a superstar. No, they got released most of the time for a reason. To say they got released. You don't have to do the other stuff with it. But you certainly don't have to go out of your way to belittle every single contract that a player does on their own when it doesn't deserve it. At least do some type of thoughtful analysis on it. So I think that was just kind of an interesting little sidebar this week that kind of came out again. But just something to keep in mind when some of these contracts come through where somebody doesn't necessarily have somebody working for them. All right. Let's take a look at questions for this week. I'll start with the email. I think I only got one. I'll take a look at this one after the fact. I don't have time to look at it right now. All right, Gavin says, with void years at the forefront discussion these days, would you still try to match cash to cap as much as possible if you're running a team? Or are there too many exceptions with rookie contract QBs and star vets on a win now roster that's truly case by case? I would never go cash to cap. Ever, 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 ever. I think it's a bad strategy. If you look historically at teams, and I've done studies on this, we've published a couple of them, There is no level of dead money that precludes you from being a decent football team unless it becomes excessive. And the excessive numbers, it's really not the dead money that's causing you to lose. It's probably the fact that just means that you've completely gutted your roster, so you've gotten that much dead money on your team. But if you actually go back and you look at the teams that have run cash to cap, more often than not, those teams are some of the lousier performers year over year. versus the better ones. Some dead money is a good thing. Some dead money means you took some risk on your roster. And it means you, maybe it didn't pan out and you had to cut those players. But what you were doing is you were trying to find a efficient way to optimize the way that you could spend to build your team. When you go cash to cap, while you might be minimizing your dead money on a piece of paper, it doesn't mean you're minimizing your dead money overall. I'd use Tampa Bay as an example because they're the team that really was completely 100% cash to cap. And before Brady got there, they didn't win a thing. But if you look at some of their deals, if you look at some of the players, just because you didn't take dead money on paper for a player doesn't mean they were any good. You know, I'll use a good player as an example. So obviously Mike Evans has been terrific, you know, since he signed. But let's say Mike Evans wasn't. And let's say you went cash to cap with him, you know, which they did. You know, every year, let's say he earned $16 million, give or take a little bit. Well, if he had been a bust and you cut him after 2 years, you would say, well, we didn't have any dead money for him. We can move on. You know, so that's great for us. But that also meant that the last 2 years you spent $32 million in cap space on him when every other team in the league would have spent, let's say, 24. Well, even though you had no dead money on the books this year, you basically had that baked into the contract because you had a subpar player that you were going to cut the minute his guarantees ran out. And you were operating from a salary cap position that was about $8 million less in total over those 2 years than every other team in the league with an equivalent player. So going cash to cap really just puts dead money into the year that the players are actually still on the roster for you versus sticking into the future. So there's always going to be an acceptable level of dead money that gives you the opportunity to add one or two more players to your team without impacting your ability to win in the future. So like I said, there is an excessive number, but I think there's also a number that's so low, it's probably a bad thing. You know, that there might be teams who are so perfect that they don't get much dead money. But more often than not, no dead money is a more of a byproduct of we're a team that doesn't take any risk. And we've basically taken the dead money by just assuming that risk in the cap hits in our current time frame. And I don't think that that's necessarily the best way for teams to go. All right, let's take a look now at Twitter. Let me go ahead and ask three times for questions. So let's see. Okay, just a couple questions tonight. So good. This should be, unless I really go off on a tangent, hour and a half versus 2 hours. All right, Some Quiet Guy says, is fully guaranteed the standard going forward for quarterbacks? Any other positions, players you think outside of quarterbacks and get fully guaranteed, like Watson and Kirk? So one of the misconceptions about fully guaranteed is all these young players that are drafted have had fully guaranteed contracts for ages. So obviously there's people who get fully guaranteed deals. So I think what we're talking about is veteran players, second contract, getting a fully guaranteed contract that's going to run for 3 or more years. So my opinion on the situation is you will not see that. There's too much risk in the players for them to do it. I think if you have quarterbacks get to free agency, they would get it. Remember, Kirk was a free agent. So Cousins had the ability to pit some teams against each other, even if it was fake teams. And then he was just kind of able to use that precedent to keep doing these guaranteed deals over and over and over and over again. Watson was also basically a free agent. Even though you were being traded for him, that you were trading for him, it was, I guess, pretty much known that he wanted a new contract, that there was new money involved, and that you were pitting X amount of teams against themselves by saying, okay, I have interviews with Carolina, I have interviews with New Orleans, I have interviews with Atlanta, I have interviews with Cleveland. So you very publicly know that I have four teams interested in me. What are you going to pay me to make me sign? What are you going to do to make me sign? So you had very unique situations. That is not the same situation as the Jacksonville Jaguars a couple of years from now, if Trevor Lawrence turns out to be good, saying, listen, buddy, we can franchise tag you two times or three times and we'll keep having this discussion, or you can take this deal that we're proposing. So I think the situations are very, very different, and I don't think you're going to see it unless the players are a free agent. I definitely don't think you'll see it at other positions. If you do, and the contracts themselves are not discounted, I think you'll see it die pretty quickly because the players will tail off so fast, you'll just be stuck with expensive paperweights. Now, this was a discussion that I had years ago. I think it would be interesting to do a fully guaranteed contract if you got a massive discount on it. And what I mean by that is when you sign a player to, say, a five-year deal, more often than not, you're signing him for those first two years. Maybe in the best case scenarios, three. Years four and five are funny money. So if I'm going to guarantee years four and five, well, I don't want years four and five to be funny money anymore. I want years four and five to be something that I view as a realistic number. So for example, on a Von Miller deal now, Von Miller's pretty old, so it's harder to utilize that contract in reality, but you know, that's an example where they added extra years to make the numbers higher. You know, in the kind of deal I'm suggesting, you would do a deal that might pay him $5 million a year in those last couple of contracts, similar to what the Aaron Rodgers actual structure is, even though we know he probably will never play at those numbers. But that's what I would do, is you want to give yourself the benefit. If this is the one player who exceeds the contract, if I'm going to fully guarantee this thing, I need a couple of guys to hit that are going to be playing for cheap for me on the back end. The problem with that premise is the players are going to go crazy the minute that they're not making as much money. You know, look at Xavier Howard. You know, look at the Bills making sure that Stephon Diggs got paid. Now, I'll talk about Diggs next week. When we actually get those details, I think that's a bad decision by Buffalo, but let's wait to see the full numbers on that one before I'll jump to that. But I think Buffalo is very focused on the Super Bowl, and I think these are bad decisions for their long term. But anyway, yeah, I don't think that the full guarantee thing is really going to happen in the way that I'm envisioning or the way that anyone else is. Kind of says, why do you think the Titans always fly under the radar? Nobody talks about them. Five straight winning seasons, small market, Indy's smaller, however, hit topic in every talk show. So, yeah, I think the market has a lot to do with it. I think they're not a very exciting football team. I don't think they have been. I think even when you go back to the days of Steve McNair, it's just a kind of a boring team. And that's not to say that that's bad. I mean, that's a good thing that you have the ability to kind of win that type of football games. But when you talk about Indianapolis, Indianapolis has got a big push from all those years of Peyton Manning, some of the years of Andrew Luck. So you have a lot more focus, I think, that comes on that organization because of that. I think the organization itself also does a better job of putting themselves out there. Maybe in the owner's case, maybe a little too much at times. But I think they do a better job of that. I don't think Indianapolis does at all. I think Indianapolis has overall, I think they have more accessible reporters. I think Tennessee only has one or two who kind of get that following versus a couple guys that do it for Indianapolis. So I think that's part of it. But I do think overall, I do think it's the market thing is something like that. I don't think Jacksonville, unless Lawrence becomes that level of star, I think Jacksonville would have a very difficult time transcending to a national level. But I think when your quarterback is Ryan Tannehill and a lot of the games you play have that feel of like the trudging through the mud, winning on the Derrick Henry kind of running stuff, it's just a, it's not something that gets that kind of attention. And I know people ask me all the time, well, why don't you talk about the Titans more? And this is one of the reasons why. So one of the things is from a contract standpoint, they're kind of boring. You know, there's nothing bad. There's just nothing exciting either. So that's one of the things. But the other thing, too, is that I don't get a lot of people that really ask me about the Titans. You know, I don't get into the stuff that other people would do where, you know, when you really focus on this stuff, you focus on the teams that really have a lot of interaction with you. You know, the fan bases that have a lot of interaction. But I could tell you that the just from the standpoint of talking with people on Twitter, and now I'm a Jets fan, so I take the Jets one, you know, as something different. That's something that's just specific to me. But, you know, I get tons of people that ask me questions on the Cowboys. You get tons of questions about the Patriots. You get a lot of questions about the Chiefs. You get right now a lot of questions about the Bills. You get tons of questions on the Packers. You get lots of questions on the Raiders, on the Broncos, you know, and so on and so forth. The teams that I get very little on are the Titans, Jacksonville. Unless I say something negative on Jacksonville. Jacksonville is another fan base that's very sensitive. Anyway, I'm just trying to think of other teams here. Yeah, I think through the years, I'm just looking at the teams that I probably get the most on would probably be, in no particular order, New England, Pittsburgh, Kansas City, the Raiders, Philadelphia, Giants, Dallas, Green Bay, Minnesota, New Orleans. Seattle. Those are probably the ones that I think stand out as the ones that get the most. And it fluctuates. You know, there's teams that jump in and jump out. The ones that I get the least about, and in turn I usually talk the least about, again, no particular order here. I'm just looking division by division. Miami, Cincinnati, Jacksonville, Tennessee, the Chargers, Detroit. Those are probably the ones. The Rams are kind of tough to say, because when the Rams were in St. Louis, I did used to get a decent amount of questions about them. And in the move to LA, there was a drop off, and obviously now that's up again. So I don't know exactly where I would rank them, but I think with Tennessee, I think it has a lot to do with that, that it's just a team that doesn't have that kind of following to push forward. Flip says, Trubisky has incentives if he starts 60% of the games in 2022. Why is that considered not likely to be earned? Because he didn't start 60% of the games last year. So it's all based on what you did the prior year. So it's all based on what he did in 2021. Can you look up the top tight end pass catchers and see what their OTC valuation would be if they were placed in a wide receiver algorithm? With a run on wide receiver contracts, you have to imagine Kelce, Waller, and Andrews would be over 20. Now, next year, I'm hoping to tweak this a little bit to do them more. We'll have two valuations. I got to figure out the right way to do it. So this is kind of based on numbers in a year and how stuff would spread out evenly. I think really a question like that would be more along the lines of what it would be worth as a player who's a free agent. So I think that's something new that I'll try to add next year, because the way that the position is outlaid, meaning you get so much production from low-cost rookies, it's very hard to really justify any receiver at $20 million a year. But primarily that's just because players don't last that long on veteran contracts and still be productive. So the way that this stuff is measured is all about overall productivity and the ultimate expense that kind of goes into the position. And for the most part, veterans, because there's not that many of them that last for a long time, they don't impact the numbers as much there. So when you have a lot of production that comes from rookies, it drives the numbers down. So, you know, I don't think that the tight ends would really be valued much over 15, you know, your best tight ends, because your best receivers, we don't value much over 15 in terms of their overall contribution. Now, if you do them on a free agent scale, that's a completely different ballgame, because then really what we're doing is we're just looking at veteran players and what those players are deemed worthy of on the open market. There you have scenarios where, yeah, I think that if you took tight ends and you valued those tight ends on the wide receiver scale, you would have players that are worth probably $18 million a year. You know, Andrews, Kelsey, Kittle, you know, those kind of players would probably be worth in that ballpark as a free agent. But that might be something that we will have this year. Humbaba says, if Rodgers doesn't like the Packers offseason, decides to retire, what are the financial implications? Let's see. Aaron Rodgers. So they can recover part of his bonus. I don't think they would, but let's see. So if they... Do I have all those? Yeah, I'd have to run... Let me look on my... back end numbers here. His is a complex contract. So I think it would be about $40.3 million in dead money. I'm just trying to see what's left here. So from 2023, he had 7.6. And yeah, it'd be about 40 dead if they decide to trade him or if he decides he wants to retire. Now, of his money this year, I have to remember, because part of it, I think it's partial signing bonus, partial roster bonus. So if he retired, they could ask for money back. I don't know if they would, because the way the numbers are structured here, I don't think they envision even this bonus payment this year as like a prepayment on the contract. I think it's envisioned as just a legitimate part of the contract. So I would say that would be the one. Now, I think what you're talking about is next year's. I mean, if he retired this year, that would be something different. But I can't imagine that would happen this year. So that's from next year's perspective. Brian says, what does a successful season look like for the Jaguars? I think given the money that they spent, the coach that they brought in, and the expectations on the quarterback, I think if they're not a wild card team, it would be considered a disappointing season. I might even go so far to say it'd be disappointing if they didn't win a game in the playoffs, but I won't go that far. I'll just say the playoffs. Dave says, salary cap is determined by non-guaranteed money. Why not have the cap determined by what is guaranteed? Do I have that right? Thanks. No. So the salary cap is actually determined by the revenues that are actually generated by the NFL. So basically what it is, it's not a 50-50 split, but as a rough estimate, you could say a 50-50 split, or you could say a 48-52 kind of split. 48% of that money goes to the players, and that becomes in turn the salary cap after you take a couple of benefits and stuff off the top. So it's not based on the wages that players earn. It's based on the revenues the NFL brings in. Turner says, how much credit should we give the Saints guy for pushing the cap into the future every year? you can give them as much credit as you want. You know, if they have a successful run year over year, I guess you would say it was a successful strategy. Thus far, that really hasn't been the case. So I think you wait to see. They don't do creative stuff. Like, the Saints do nothing different than the Falcons were doing. I don't know what credit you really give there. The strength of the Saints in terms of their contract stuff really has come on the initial negotiations. I think the numbers they get, the structures of the deals, and the overall values, I think most of the time are pretty fair, Taysom Hill excluded. I think most of the stuff is pretty fair. I would say a lot of it actually trends in New Orleans' favor. But the stuff that goes on after that, any team in the NFL could do it. It's just a question of, does it catch up with you? So I don't really know if you really give much credit to that or not. But was Julio Jones the worst offseason move last year? If not, what was? Well, no, the worst offseason move was the Kenny Golladay, Adoree Jackson signings by the Giants. I think those were the worst moves. Even if a guy like Jackson somehow works out, it was just the money, the numbers, none of that made sense. And it was such a turn from what it looked like the Giants were doing to what they ended up doing with those two players back to back. It just didn't make sense at all. The Jones one was a risk worth taking, I think. I don't think the Woods one is, but I think the Jones one was a risk worth taking. You know, the risks were there. It was pretty obvious. You were taking a player who plays indoors and you're putting him outside. That's always a negative. You're taking a player who's a legend on another team and you're putting him in a new offense. None of it worked. Wasn't healthy. You know, he's an older player. But I definitely wouldn't call that the worst move of the year. Let's see. Next question up. Jack, if the Browns restructure Watson's deal each of the next 3 years, I predict $325.5 before year four. Does that seem about right, provided he plays well? So you're assuming that he gets restructured so much that they have to extend him again. I don't think that those numbers would end up there. So on a 3 year extension? All right, let me see. Watson has steady salaries in those years, right? At 46. I think it's 46 straight. So let me just pull those out. Let's see. So we take out 325. Whoops. That would be 233 over 3. No, I don't see that at all. I don't think so. I don't think any of those would work. If you're talking about a new contract, $78 million a year, $65 million a year, depending on how you value it, I don't envision that. That to me is too far of a jump. So I don't think so. I mean, maybe if the salary cap really, really, really explodes, maybe something like that will happen. But I don't think so, because that type of money that you're talking about, I mean, they could just tag him a couple times. I guess I'd have to see where the cap ended up, because you're talking about them restructuring the next 3 years in a row. So I think he'd probably end up less than that. But I'd have to see a little bit more. Matt says, looking at the new wide receiver deals, do these large second-year cap hits favor the players, meaning the teams that have to do restructures put the cap hits out, which makes cutting guys in the future more expensive? Is this normal contract structure? The agents asking for this. So I think this has kind of become the norm with the way contracts are doing. I don't think most agents are really looking at it that way. I think in the past they used to. And maybe in the future they will. I think right now they're just focused on how much money they're bringing in the first 2-3 years of a deal and getting those deals done because of that. But yeah, it's absolutely right. Structure matters so much in these contracts. when you do these deals that have these massive second year cap hits and you're forced to restructure them, you're basically guaranteeing that third year of the deal. You know, even though you didn't guarantee it on a piece of paper, you're probably guaranteeing it with those contracts, unless you've just gone off a cliff to where you've decided you have to go in there and just cut everybody. You kind of are doing that. So I always look at the concept of the restructure as almost like a guarantee that my guy's going to be on the roster next year. You know, that's why, even though these were pay cuts, I mean, that's why DeMarcus Lawrence and Frank Clark are still on their teams. You know, that it's all about the structure of the deals and what those teams did to comply with the cap. Dave here says, with the anticipated upcoming spike in the cap stemming from new TV deals and gambling, how will the smart front offices use this to their advantage, be aggressive with extensions and free agency before the spike, take a big hit on QB and spike here? That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that, because you have two things. So there's only a handful of teams that I think are going to be willing to really pay up because of the increased cap. Most of the others are probably focused more on getting some type of price stability in there while also being somewhat fiscally responsible. I would guess that what you will see are the teams who are better at this, the Eagles, the 49ers, some of those types of teams. I think what you will see them do is probably offer extensions to players who are kind of unproven, you know, show a lot of promise, kind of unproven, and do an extension for those players where you kind of scratch your head a little bit and go, man, why are they paying that guy so much money? And I think what they're just looking to do is paying him that much money to get in before the cap spike. But number two, know that when you do pay a subpar player that amount of money, like, for example, the Jaguars or Christian Kirk, that's going to have ramifications on the rest of the NFL. Now, the wide receiver market's a little bit different because everything is so tight. But realistically, what that would do is, if I'm going to sign Christian Kirk to $18 a year, well, that probably means every other team that was budgeting $18 a year for their receivers now is going to have to pay them $23 or $24. So in a sense, it kind of comes back full circle that while you've overpaid for your specific player, that overpayment is probably going to only impact you 1, maybe 2 years, depends on how many players are up for new contracts. And the market itself, you're kind of forcing that correction on the market. You're forcing teams to spend more than they originally thought. So, you know, in that sense, maybe that balances out a little bit. So I think you'll just see some teams kind of push it in that regard. And I think that's probably what they'll do. I think that's the one area that we might see some teams exploit stuff. All right, let's see. What do we have here? Should Chiefs fans panic somewhat if they ever restructure Mahomes' deal? No. I wouldn't worry about it. I think what you just have to make sure that you do with Mahomes, because of the way some of those numbers jump up as years go on, I think you don't want to restructure him every single year. And I think that's one of the reasons why they didn't do that this year. I think his contract is done in a way to where you want to restructure his deal every 2 years or every 3 years. You know, that pushes the numbers out enough to where you can figure out how to deal with those larger cap hits that show up. So, yeah, I don't think there is ever going to be a panic about it, but I think you just have to be smart about what you do with the restructures, because your benefit on that contract is, number one, you got him cheap, you know, relative to his talent level. But number two is, by getting him cheap like that, you have the ability to kind of also take a salary cap advantage. they took a lot of that advantage in the front end of the contract. You don't want to put yourself at a disadvantage by having cap hits that are always more than the rest of the league, because you've got a favorable scenario. So you have to pick and choose when you're going to do those restructures, and then make sure they work in a manner that benefits, you know, you and the way that you're building your team. You know, it's kind of what I talked about before about building dead money into a contract. Same thing. It's finding the most efficient use of your money with the way that you kind of structure those cap hits. Steezo says, why did the Anthony Barr dead cap hit drop this week? I believe it was 10.8 at some point, and then it was 9.89. I believe that was held at some point in the offseason. NFLPA report adjusted the overall Vikings cap similarly. I have no idea if they did. I made a data entry error. That was all it was. So I would guess if their number dropped this week, it was actually something completely different. I don't think it was because of that. I don't know what I did. I happened to catch it this week. I just made a mistake. And the only reason I caught it was Field Yates had an NFL report that he put out the other week, or the other day. It wasn't the other week. Where he had some of the numbers on the teams. And I was just looking at some of the teams I was more off on and just trying to come up with reasons why. In some cases, it was that players, we had contract details for guys who had signed deals but agreed to deals but hadn't officially signed them yet. But the Barr deal specifically was, I made a mistake. Wasn't anything more than that. It wasn't anything different. I just, I made a mistake in the number I put in there. I think what I did is I think maybe I took his number with a minimum salary or something like that in there. I don't even remember now. I'm just pulling up his page. Yeah, I just made a mistake with it, and I'm not sure why I did that. But yeah, it was just that was just data entry error on my part. But they probably did something different. Eddie says, with Debo looking to become the highest paid non-quarterback, what should he legitimately look to get? Will he need to move to get it? So San Francisco is going to be an interesting spot when it comes to his deal. So first of all, you have what are we talking about when he's like the highest paid non-quarterback? Are we talking about funny money terms? Like I need to make more than Tyreek Hill's $30 million a year? Sure, that's not a problem because it's all funny money. The only worry for San Francisco at that point is what happens if you want to craft a contract where you envision being able to get a compensatory pick for him if his contract were to expire. You can't get that with the Tyreek Hill funny money $30 million a year deal. But if they're willing to go that route, doesn't mean anything. It just means you do a deal with him that's 5 years in length. 4 years are real. You add on a fifth year for $60 million to bring that number up. So if that's what he's talking about, you know, you're looking at $31 million a year. If we're talking about real terms, which I guess the highest would be an edge rusher probably right now. Maybe it's going to be Aaron Donald when he resigns. You're looking at a legitimate $28 million a year. I don't think San Francisco would go for that. I don't think it would make any sense for them. Now, San Francisco is going to have some problems when it comes to that. You do have instances where San Francisco has made players the highest paid at their position, whether it was Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback, Trent Williams at left tackle. It will probably be Nick Bosa when he becomes when he gets his new deal. So I think it's a situation where San Francisco can't really fight as much over it, but I do think there's going to be a fight on what that value is, what that number is, and how legitimate that number might be. The Trent Williams contract isn't completely legitimate either. You know, they threw an extra year in there to get him to that number. But I would guess that, you know, that they would have to make him the highest paid. But if we're going in those terms, the highest paid is either going to be 24 or 25. It depends on how you look at Tyreek Hill's deal. But that gets you to the highest paid wide receiver. It doesn't get you the highest paid overall. So I think if we're talking legitimate contracts, the needle mover number is probably right around $25 million a year. If we're talking funny money, it's 31. If we're talking he wants $30 million for real, you're just going to take him to the franchise tag two times and let him walk. Troy is on vacation. Texans cap has a red stripe tonight. Big thumbs up for me for that one. Always good to relax with a beer. All right, let's see. Last set of questions. Drew in LA, who is my question? Who are you? Well, I'm assuming you're not listening, but I'm the guy that runs the Over the Cap website. So that is me. The People's Champ, comment on Titans cap situation for 2022 and 2023 and how advantageous it is to trade Tannehill next year's offseason. What would a trade like if the Titans traded Taylor Lewan? So look at that. Two Titans questions tonight. Let's pull them up. Teams, Titans. All right. So if they traded Tannehill next year, they would create 17-8. You know, they're in a bad spot next year. They only have $10 million projected cap room. That's low relative to the rest of the league. Let's see. What would a trade look like if they traded Lewan? So next year, they would save 14-8. I think that's his last year. Is that his last year under contract? I think it might be. Yeah. So, I mean, if they are looking to gut the roster, those are two player contracts that you would look to move. But, you know, I don't know if they're looking to gut the roster. But they're overall, I mean, they're not in a great position with their cap. They've gone all in, I think, with this team. And I mentioned this before. If it was me, I think I'd be looking more at a retooling phase and probably looking at ways to find some insurance behind Tannehill. So maybe I could think of moving on versus really what they're doing, which just seems to be kind of keeping the band together and finding one or two parts you can add to it in the hope that they get a little bit better next year for a playoff run. Does Marquise Brown get an extension from the Ravens or is he traded within the next 2 years? I would lean more towards a trade than an extension. He has some talent. I don't think that you've been thrilled with what he's given you so far. I think you expected more. And obviously he gives you some big plays. It's not like he doesn't. He did have 1,000 yards last year. But I don't know. I think you expected more from him when you drafted him. So I would envision him more along the lines, and you see how things work out this year. But I would envision them to look at him more along the lines right now of like being like a Sammy Watkins type, not the same type of player, just that the salary expectations might be very high and maybe there is a team out there that's willing to pay that. And if that's the case, maybe you should try to find that team and trade him away to bring something back, because I don't know if that's a great fit. The negative is that you just don't have a lot of receivers there right now. That's never really been a strong point for that team and continues to be that. But I think if he's looking at a $23 million a year contract, I just don't see what logic there would be in doing that if you're the Ravens. Chris says, what would it take for the NFL to get rid of the salary cap? They would never do it. Never. I don't know anything the players could give up to get rid of the salary cap. 52 games? I mean, I have no idea. Ken, should NFL fans have to suffer through another day of big name media showing their hate, even in times of sorry? Employment changes are due. What do you think? So I'm assuming that's to You know, the tragic story today. So Dwayne Haskins passed away after being hit by a vehicle. And I guess there were, I didn't follow along as much, but I guess Gil Brandt did a radio spot, which was just bizarre. He's a really old man. I think you lose focus. I think that's something that a lot of people do that cover sports. You lose focus that there's people under the helmets, under the baseball cap, dribbling the basketball, whatever the sport is, that there's like a human being involved that's separate from what they do on the football field, you know, what they do in the practice rooms, or practice room, what they do in the meeting rooms, what they do in practice. Like, it's just, they're people. But sometimes we just focus on them as, I guess, just as their, you know, ability as an athlete. And, you know, the stuff he said was just crazy. The other one was, I guess, Schefter's story had a very negative twist about his time, you know, in the NFL. And there's a time and place for that. If you're writing a biography on a player, when you're doing a story, just kind of saying that, you know, somebody in the NFL passed away, I don't really know what the purpose of that aspect of the story is. You know, if you're writing a retrospective on his career or something, you would write about that. I mean, you would write about his incredible successes in college, some of the difficulties he had in the NFL. But I don't know, it was just kind of out of place for ESPN and that the type of article they were doing. Like, it didn't belong in there. Like, if you were saying, you know, Dwayne Haskins' career, you know, and taking a fair but I guess critical view of it, I mean, I guess you could bring that up, but the Gil Brandt stuff was just, I don't know, they just shouldn't have put him on the radio. Like, they, I don't know how they have to do that. You know, it just didn't have a place. It was just kind of it's just a sad story. You know, and I don't think the football aspect shouldn't have come into play today at all. You know, it just shouldn't have, you know, but I can understand certain things that you would write where it did, but it really in both of those cases, it just didn't have a place. I don't know about employment changes. I do think there's something to be said about some of the really old guard of the NFL and trotting them out there to give perspective on stuff when they shouldn't be. But, you know, at the same time, there are people now not as old as Gil Brandt, not who have been involved in, as long as that. But I mean, like, Bill Polian is very engaging. I probably don't agree with him on a lot of things he says about football. I certainly don't agree with him on a lot of stuff he talks about with contracts and salary cap and stuff, but he's very engaging. But I think when you have older generation NFL people on, you just want to have them focused on, I don't know, telling old stories and stuff like that. You know, the Schefter stuff, you know, that's not his realm doing those kind of things. You know, he's a newsbreaker and he's good at that. So they probably should just kind of keep it to that versus the other stuff. You know, as for the changing, it's tough. You know, like, I'll go through and I'm old now, but like, you know, I'll look at, and it's a totally different topic, but I'll look at the radio programming that's on some of the stations, and like, some of it to me isn't good. Like, I'd rather have the style of some of the older people, even if some of the stuff they would say doesn't fit in as much now. I'm talking about the New York market and some of the stuff nationally, which really would be the changes on ESPN from Mike and Mike to the current programming. And I wasn't the biggest Mike and Mike fan. I thought in terms of doing like a hard hitting show, it wasn't that at all, but it was a fun enough show. If you listened every now and then, flipping back and forth between in my area, you know, 660 and that. So it's kind of hard for me to say. I don't think I'm the right generation to probably talk about doing those kind of changes. But yeah, I think, you know, especially if you're going to write that stuff, there should be somebody above you that's reading over that and just saying, you know, there's a different way to write this, or there's a different time for that part of the story. You know, and for the Gilbrants, you just don't bring them on for these types of things. You know, it's not a football story. It's just a sad story that a football player was involved in. Hazy or hoppy? What do you lean towards? Hoppy. That's the IPA question. Will the huge wide receiver market spike persist? Do you think it'll cause more of a run in the draft? No. I don't think it's going to persist. I think Hill will block at 25, or it'll be right around that number. You might see a little bit more move, but I don't think you're going to see this massive jump in the salaries. I think the run in the draft is going to happen regardless. I don't think that'll be a thing, but I do think you are seeing a difference in approach where certain teams with those with certain quarterbacks or certain contract structures are moving away from the wide receivers. At least from the veteran side, high priced, while the teams are clearly buying into him. Finn says, worst contract in the last 20 years. Is it Albert Haynesworth? Any honorable mentions? Well, the Haynesworth deal certainly worked out as probably the worst deal. Mario Williams to Buffalo was bad. Marcel Darius in Buffalo was atrocious. The Raiders, my goodness. They did so many bad deals. I'd have to look through. A couple years ago, I was looking at doing a series on the worst contracts of all time. But as I started to get into it, I almost felt like it was doing a biography on the Oakland Raiders organization. So I thought that it was like way too much of a hit job on Oakland. So I kind of moved away from it. Maybe one of these days I'll go back to that premise, but it's going to have a lot of Raiders deals on there. I'm trying to think of other deals that were really bad. You know, the Watkins deal was a recent one that was terrible. You know, there have been a couple, so I'll have to think about that a little bit. But you know, that would take us back. Definitely would include a lot of those Raiders ones that were basically retirement payments for players who never even played there. All right, I think that's it. Let me see, is there anything else? Let's see. Just checking here. Nope, I think that is it for me. So we got in under 2 hours today, so that's pretty good. So everybody have a great week. Nelly, anything? No, but I did get the... We did get the nice sound from all the rain that we've had. We have the pump going off constantly down here because everything is soaked through from all that. But luckily, we didn't flood out like we have in years past. So that's a big thumbs up. So everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.